So there's no problem understanding another if we speak the same verbal language. It's what my next move is going to be, whether verbal, gestural, or indifferent. That is of interest to the other who just spoke to me, and therein is the drama of cognition. For both of us, because I have to expect a response to my response from the other, even if we don't speak the same language, there will still be this drama of response, and my response may satisfy what the other's foreign words requested. Later, circumstances unfold that reveal a problem in what we thought we communicated in either case. In retrospect, we will wonder how the previous exchange failed to declare the unforeseen problem. This is the first rhythm of consciousness, of thought, of memory, of the subliminal, of the consequences of extrasensory perception. This is the drama enacted in the mud and jute section of Finnegan's Wake, page 16 to 18, the first dialogue in the book. Then shortly after, James Joyce writes, "In the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that wets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweeten sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. The implied impression is ESP, is
okay,
it not?"
Okay, don't you say end of quote?
Oh, end of quote, okay. "The implied impression is ESP, is it not? And the ignorance is the assumption that a connection has been made. The next 10 clauses, stages, are the autonomic, archetypal consequences of this environment of perception. All of subsequent cultural production and residue proceeds from that original drama of cognition, however rudimentary the utterance."
Okay, so maybe I'll say this. That interplay, which a little later I'm going to call blocking and merging, is what I understand tactility is. Tactility is not, the tactile is not embedded in one side or the other. It's not just a blocker. It's not just a memory. It's both plus other things. And the interplay, ongoing interplay of body language and whatever else is communicated, different parts of the people's environment, clothing, what they're doing. Let's call that tactility, the interplay. So that's the original sensation. And ESP is the mind maybe coming in and interpreting what's happening, or thinking is interpreting, and maybe getting proven later that they were ahead of the game in the interpretation, or it was wrong. So the subtlety of this interplay, rather than just two people talking at each other, verbalizing at each other, the multisensory nature of the mutt and jute section of Finnegan's Wake, because it's not just simple English, it's multiple languages and puns, and that would be Joyce's way to show there's more than just verbal matching going on. There's making, what McLuhan called making, making of meaning, making of a impression of an interpretation of data. All that comes under the term tactile or the tactility. So I don't say that there. We'll see if I say it later. But that's what I would say now about that. That is not, hasn't been uttered yet, that word tactile. So you look at that quote from Joyce, page 18, "In the ignorance that implies impression," so there has to be an openness. So that would be an allowance. That might be a merging. So in the merging that implies impression, allows impression of one person impressing the other person, that then creates concepts, memory, that knits knowledge, it finds the name form, that wets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetens sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. Now, if you look up Roland McHugh's notes, annotations to Finnegan's Wake, this apparently has the 12-fold aspects of Buddhism. It's sort of like Buddhism's stages of apprehension, This is what some interpreters of Finnegan's Wake think is being echoed here. So that's just a side note. That's probably all I want to say. Let me just see where the blocking merging, that sort of comes in, I think, soon. I don't see it. But, okay,
couple paragraphs down.
Okay. And that blocking and merging is the interplay of the web and flow, what do you call it, the ebb and flow of tides. That's sort of like a visual presentation of this. It's done slowly. But so this basic interplay, interaction, is the core human experience. Okay, so what happens next? We go to Manhattan.
If one lives in Manhattan and gets the public access channel 67, one can watch well-made videotapes of Jiddu Krishnamurti, 1895 to 1986, one of the few men to reject the preferred role of world messiah, retrace verbally and consciously every week, Tuesdays 10 a.m., the drama of cognition between two or more human beings. Access.
Okay, hold it. It's the, he rejected the proffered or offered role of world messiah. It's correcting the way you said the word.
Okay. Accessing.
Okay, so he rejected a focus on him, a monad experience. He'd be the monad, and the world would, people would become monists if they got into his, quote, cult. But he never stopped teaching. And eventually it got videotaped. And so I would watch those when I discovered them on Manhattan Cable TV in 1998. I watched every week, like on a Tuesday, as it says here, for 2 years. So I saw a lot of Krishnamurti. And so I'm going to use him as a reference point to what I had just said in the first paragraph.
Accessing.
So he retraces. He retraces verbally and consciously every week the drama of cognition between two or more human beings.
Is that how you first discovered it? Oh, no, you discovered it through James Joyce.
No, I knew it went on with people, but when I started to watch, because I'd heard his audio for years, but I never saw him while speaking. And you'll see how sensitive he is to the audience response and occasionally comment on it and either mock the audience or... genuinely ask him, are you following this? So he's very interactive. You know, in academic lectures, the professor doesn't usually, if he's at some conference, doesn't ask for audience response while he's reading his paper, which makes it very dull. Now, that's what I noticed about Trump in the videos in 2016, that he would look at the audience and point and look for a response, not just rant. And so I thought, well, that's what I do when I speak in public. I interact. I almost like try to keep it on an interactive speech level, not a one-way song, to quote Wyndham Lewis. Be responsive to people's quiet responses. They may not be saying things, but they could be thinking things. So I'm always interested in, like I'll say during this, anybody wants to interrupt, go ahead. So your next sentence, accessing Krishnamurti.
Through this video medium allows attention to the words, tones, and facial expressions that cannot be equaled by those who attended the original talk or who read the transcript, no matter how successfully they prepared beforehand by cleansing their auras, aligning their chakras, or assuming the lotus meditation posture. The video experience...
Yeah, so that's a bit of teasing. The thing about the video, you'd be very close to Krishnamurti, close up on his face. Now, I've seen Krishnamurti in public, and you're far away. You don't see these little nuances in his eyes and nose and facial muscle moving. This is what's great about video. So video is showing you aspects of people that you can't do in the chemical body. Often, you don't stare and look at nervous tics, you'll pick it up, but you don't make a big deal about it because it's sort of rude. But with TV or in private, you can really study, you can rewind, you can do all kinds of things that no one could. So the videotape and the instant replay brought in a new level of experience for humans in communication. That's important. That's interesting. Okay, so that's what I'm pointing out, that the value of Krishnamurti were incredible on these videotapes.
Mm-hmm. The video experience of Krishnamurti may be a distortion like any other medium, but this is the closest we can come to experiencing the your moment of civilizing impulse next to having been there. The play of cognition and the exchange of ESP is enacted before us weekly, different talks each time, to the consternation of many. At least that's how it appears to my ESP.
Yeah, my intuitions.
Mm-hmm. So why would people have consternation about Krishnamurti?
Because he's a bit rude sometimes. And he's presenting a topic, and he's sitting there, I think he's in meditation posture. Maybe he's just sitting in a chair. But he's very relaxed and poised and trying to generate peace in a way and get people to pay attention to what he's saying. Don't worry about him. Don't get distracted by his facial muscles and all that. But it's hard not to notice that stuff because that's what you do when you talk to people in person. Mm-hmm. You're picking up all kinds of smells and tastes and things. So, but Krishnamurti is very calm and focused and boring. He's talking about something that many people find obvious. And every now and then he changes his demeanor and steps out of his calming role and makes fun of people. He'll just say, "Why are you listening to me? Why are you here?" And then he doesn't get any response. So then he goes back to talking about what he's always talking about, perceiving the dream of cognition. So, people, they'll say, "I don't understand Krishnamurti." They're puzzled by him because they project what they think should be communicated in a communicating environment.
Mm-hmm.
People will judge you if you're rude. Or they get bored if you're not rude. So there's just lots of individual subjectivity, which if people talk to each other about that, they might have inspirations, they might have nice little moments of matching, but then there's always the general puzzlement of the average person who's not very aware of a lot of things, just finds the intensity of Krishnamurti's talk too much. So they feel uncomfortable about that. They say, "Why can't I enjoy it?" They get consternated. So I'm just showing the subtleties that go on in interpersonal communication. That's what I'm writing about. So there's often consternation between people.
Yeah.
They actually don't even pay attention to each other, even though they're pretending to. So he's a guy talking, and he's demanding you to pay attention to a very boring topic for most people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most people probably couldn't understand what he's saying, like what he's talking about. They can't even grasp what he's saying, even though it's very simple.
Wait, are you saying that's your case? You don't get him?
No, I do, but like other people I've spoken to just don't. Like, they would find it boring or just don't grasp what he's saying. Does it make sense?
Yeah. That's interesting.
But I remember you saying that if you were to put out a Bob Knowledge curriculum, Krishnamurti would be the first thing that you would teach.
Yeah, he's like I was saying earlier, technology came out of the Garden of Eden after we were kicked out. And so the first major technology was speech, say, something like that. Maybe it's just grunting. Well, Krishnamurti analyzes that original technology. He keeps it simple.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you would start with him.
Yeah.
It's very unique what he does as a speaker compared to, you know, many other types of speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the next paragraph.
So why call this human interplay ESP? because the baggage of semantics that comes with the word will obviously start an argument, which is the verbal and gestural aspects of the drama of cognition itself. At any rate, this particular argument has been going on for the entire history of secular society, high and low. It involves all questions of social and personal control and who or what is the agent of such and whether it is benign or malignant. And it involves all questions of ontology, epistemology, and the physical structure of existence. The history of the elitist social management especially hinges on two schools of thought based on either vertical symbolism, dialectical and continuous, or horizontal symbolism, allegorical or discontinuous. So these are two different schools of thought in the Western culture.
Yeah.
The time school and the space.
Yeah, the time school and the space school, respectively. So vertical symbolism is the time school, and horizontal symbolism is the space school.
Briefly,
so like I said in the previous paragraph, I said everything ontology, epistemology comes from this. That's me saying what I said 2 minutes ago. The original drama of people, humans interacting after they became conscious as humans and whatever that was. So that's the archetypal beginning. There's another thought about this. So as what I'm describing here, I'm being like Krishnamurti, trying to describe the essence of communication, which you would do in speech, but it's in print. So it's a bit off, but I'm being very particular about I'm being boring here. I'm just talking about the phenomenon of speech through writing. Okay? So I'm doing Krishnamurti at the beginning here.
Yeah, through writing.
Yeah.
Briefly.
So you have to go into time and space. You have to go into the coordinates that people, you're saying, where are we?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's 3:00 in the afternoon. We're here. You use time. And then where's the space coordinates? So to talk about the time and space, we're not doing that right now in general on the show. We don't, well, Greg said, hey, let's have a little announcement once a month, once an hour, saying, hey, you want to listen to us? You can do it this way or that way, a little ad. We are, what was I saying there? So, yeah, we don't talk about, you don't bring this up about where you are at the dinner table, say, three times over 20 minutes, right? You don't discuss this stuff. It's assumed you know where you are and what the space is.
Mm-hmm.
So by talking about time and space, you're questioning the your immediate sensory experience, which LaRouche would agree with. Being a Platonist, he's not into getting too involved in the sensory data, like worrying about what clothes you're wearing or any of the sensory input. And that's
right.
Boring, right? Because people like to be distracted by whatever they can experience in their senses.
Right.
So I'm not trying to be exciting here. It's not a novel. Okay,
yeah,
carry on.
Briefly, the time school uses myth and the space school uses norms. The former restrains the passions of its citizens and the latter places itself at the center and controls its citizens via the passions.
That's a point that McLuhan made in an essay in the mid-50s, talking about, the article might be God and Media and the God-Making Machines, something like that. But he talks about, through a large part of history, cultural hierarchy, class warfare, would create myths or stories, and they represented morals and limitations on behavior. And so we were controlled by the leadership imposing a pattern of knowledge on people or of information that everybody has to respect and bow to. But when you've got the electric age and people weren't controlled by speech or books or movies anymore because it was a global theater of all kinds of media. They had to stop controlling morality-wise what people did, allow them to have their passions, and then exploit their addiction to the passions and create products around that or counter environments to that you sell. So that's what it means. The modern form of management is to say it's a democracy and people are free to do this and that, and you're not imposing on them, but we're trying to make your life a little more comfortable. Maybe you need this kind of pillow or vitamin. So we place the person at the center. They're not on the margins being imposed upon by a center. That's mythic. Hal McLuhan defined myth. That's an information society. We're not controlling the information so much in the electric age. We're letting citizens run around and make mistakes and do all kinds of silly instinct living by instinct, and bungling that. That's how you control them. They are addicted to the environments you give them. So the world of norms, sociological knowledge, places itself at the center and controls the citizens via the passions. Finished.
The struggle for power between these two elitist approaches was interrupted in the 19th century with the acceleration in the creation of massive environments of technological and communicative interaction. In the 20th century, the space school limped into the winner circle by default, as the time school was no longer capable of projecting an appropriate image of the level or realm of the ship of state. Both schools
of the lever, an appropriate image of the lever or helm of the ship of state. Said level.
Oh, sorry.
School is more than the era of myth. Vertical symbolism. It's vertical. There's a hierarchy. As you get into the decentralized electric environment, it's more mass man spread out. Everybody's equally discarnate on the radio, TV, and all that. So you call it a horizontal school, and you measure what's going on by the spaces between people or between cultures, right? So that's horizontal, space school. Now, it's even weak, so I say it limped into the winner's circle because people don't know what spaces they're in when they're electrified. They can't visualize what space they're in. Mm-hmm. So it's a stopgap of retrieval, the closest of the anthropomorphic chemical body reality, that we can say we're still in touch with slightly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the time school was no longer capable of projecting an appropriate image of the lever or helm of the controllers, the ship of state. Okay, remember, you don't control people so much other than they're controlled by the environment you give them that they can engage their passions within. In other words, take away the fucking TikTok from 8-year-olds. That would be a time school move. Right?
Yeah.
You would control their passions, limit their passions. So education became less strict, and you're not allowed to win a trophy. Everybody gets a trophy for participating. That's an equality, a democracy of sharing the space that the school is presenting or the game is presenting. That's a different society than the 19th century society. Way different. Okay, so space schools limped into the winner's circle by default.
So both schools were removed from the constitutive action or formal causality of ESP generation and collective consciousness because the electric telegraph was the first time the process of knowing had been extended to involve all members of a culture and all other existing cultures in the simultaneity of a collective equally shared perception. The mirror of
So that's a big paragraph there, or a bunch of words. So I'm putting in ESP to and calling it generation, making it a cliche, not making a big deal out of ESP, all that people think it means when they use that acronym, ESP, extrasensory perception. So I'm trying to control the interpretation of ESP and make it conventional and be part of your, well, it's your intuition. So I'm throwing that in. You know, people don't talk about that too much. They might say, use the word intuition, though. But I'm taking that word with a bad reputation or a strange reputation and throwing it in there on purpose. Okay?
Okay. The mirror of this new social fact was the Daily Cross, the cross-section of the community in action provided by the Telegraph Press. All the arts and sciences, especially in the West, became subject to endless crises in a futile search for new models to restore old values and retrieve forgotten traditions of ESP, both social and private.
Yeah, so what I'm saying there is pretty close to what McLuhan says in Counterblast on page 31. So I'm trying to, you know, not use McLuhan jargon, but I've got what he's talking about in mind when I say this. When they make statements like all the arts and sciences, blah, blah, blah. That's the way McLuhan would phrase it. All the arts and sciences no longer are anti-environmental. So I'm just explaining what I'm doing there.
So everyone wants to retrieve old forms of ESP.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, eh? People go, I don't even have ESP. What are you talking about? I don't try to retrieve an older form of it. It's a probe. It's an odd thing to say, so you stick some oddity in there to make a boring topic slightly intriguing.
So as an example,
I don't get many complaints from people who read Clone ESP. They like the article.
As an example, we want to make America great again?
No.
Oh.
who's doing that?
I don't know if this is retrieving. An old form.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. So that's example of retrieval. That's the definition of it. Let's bring something back. Mm-hmm. He wants to bring America back. What part of America? You know, it's a simplification, which is what people live by. They live by simplifications. They haven't got time to study and question where they are and what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll grab a sentence. An aphorism, a slogan, and to pretend they need that to get motivated or to get a break. Take a break from work and go to a Trump rally and pretend something significant's happening.
Some notes I wrote down was the Telegraph puts everyone on one nervous system and connects instantly. There's no more time. It kills the time school. Everyone communicates at the speed of light. And
Wait. Are you reading something?
No, I was just reading some note that I wrote.
Okay, now do that again. I was looking for what. Go ahead. Do it again.
The Telegraph puts everyone on one nervous system to connect instantly. There's no more time. It kills time school. Everyone communicates at the speed of light and access to higher tools. It erases the hierarchy and mythology. Everybody's equal. Everybody enjoys the same things. It's all electric.
Right. Just say your first words again.
The Telegraph puts everyone on one nervous system.
Okay. Now here's the being a perfect perfectionist grammarian. It actually puts you out of the nervous system because it's an extension of the nervous system. It's a new nervous system. So read that again now with that in mind.
The Telegraph puts everyone outside of the nervous system. You have a new nervous system.
Wait a minute. You just read what you read to me. Don't change it.
The Telegraph puts everyone on one nervous system.
Yeah, puts everyone on one nervous system. If you want to call the Telegraph sloppily as an extension of the nervous system, just the nervous system, Mm-hmm. And you're not telling what time of day it is or the actual spatial aspects grammatically, then we accept it. But we're trying to get you to note things in every moment. So it's not that's not an accurate way to describe what the telegraph does. It doesn't put you on one nervous system. It puts you into a new weird state of discarnate reality, electrified reality. And then what is that? The nervous system is not a comprehensive phrase to cover that.
Okay.
That's why McLuhan would say it's an extension of the nervous system. Not the nervous system. It's something extended or different or expanded.
Okay. All right, I'll continue with your words.
Yeah.
To increase the potential for ESP between this writer and the reader lurker, let me replay the themes established so far. ESP as pattern recognition is a perceptual complex of mental and nonverbal dance, the tactile sense. However, tactility, as used here, is not one of the senses, but the interplay of the senses, evoking ordinary consciousness. Electric technology, from the telegraph on, when they become generally used and environmental, stimulated that ordinary consciousness, the tactile ESP collectively. So personal ESP now exists in parallel with the collective, ongoing, dynamic ESP, or at least until recently. But before we discuss that situation, two aspects in the drama of cognition and its stimulation must be reviewed.
Okay, hold it. That's a pretty good paragraph. Let's see. Anybody has a comment so far? Brian, do you have a comment so far?
Just vibing.
You're vibing?
I'm just vibing with the like, yep. Just like I remember,
yeah, okay.
It. Every sentence is good.
Yeah, it is pretty good. It's a new jargon or using words in an odd way, like tactile ESP. If you were really listening, you might say, what does that mean, Bob? You know what I mean? But I tried to describe it in paragraphs before, so I'd tell them to go back, reread what this drama was of you listening in the first paragraph, listening and taking in and requiring to respond to what they did in their response to you. So I'm taking these words and putting them, you know, when people talk about ESP, they don't talk this way. They talk about how you can develop your ESP. They almost don't even define it. They just say, well, it refers to a couple of unique experiences that you normally wouldn't have. So I'm playing a game here, taking a strange experience and putting into as if, well, this is ordinary consciousness, which I think is what McLuhan was doing. So I'm just imitating McLuhan here.
So a new medium makes people desperate to find their place and makes them have a new have their own culture identity in that medium?
If they've lived a bit and they're a teenager or an adult, a baby, a 1-2-year-old has no stake in the society up to that point. And so if it's a new experience and appealing, they'll just wallow in it because that's the novelty.
Mm-hmm.
It's only those that have had other experiences before the new technology came along and want to preserve those as they make time for the new invading novelty.
Right.
That's the stress of technological evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So what did I say here? Why did I say that?
Because I said that this new medium makes people desperate to find a place.
There's different levels of, you know, desperation.
Or makes them want to have their own culture identity.
Yeah, generally. Yeah, they want to keep their experience. You know, it's like two 12-year-old girls are going to school. And one of the girls says, let's go this way. The other goes, no, I'm not going that way. We always go this way. Why go there? You know, just that simple little condition like that is caused by speech is a new environment, which upsets the other person often. Or, if you're lucky, they agree to it and they enjoy the experience of doing a different route. But it's that simple. So, collectively, you bring in the hologram, and people can say, wait, this is the time when I watch TV. I'll do this later. Or, oh, good, I like the hologram. It's a new type of experience. I don't like TV. It's boring. This is the normal, cliche life of humans, sensory-wise, the dram of cognition. So we're talking real cliche here in terms of human experience. But there could be a purpose to it. I'm trying to see if I make a purpose out of doing this. A purpose in the statement of the essay.
Mm-hmm.
Can I lead to a new insight here? So that's the drama for me, the writer.
Mm-hmm. So the next paragraph goes into the blocking.
Right.
First, the blocking, so necessary to preserve individual identity of the intimate qualities of ESP, is always communicated as well when human beings interact. But when the Gutenberg printing press became an environment 500 years ago, this extension of the natural blocking process enhanced its novelty character and became a valued quality of social perception of the social ESP. That is why the scientific paradigms of Bacon, Descartes, and Newton dislodged the paradigms of natural magic and the hermeticism. The inclusive centripetal meanings of ESP were displaced for the exclusive
centrifugal
ESP. Yeah.
Centrifugal. So read that sentence again.
The inclusive centrifugal meanings of ESP were displaced for the exclusive centrifugal states of ESP. Now
yeah,
you can explain
the difference. Centripetal means centralized, going towards a commanding authority or a commanding environment. Centrifugal is when it starts to separate out and create different subjectivities or different environments, not so controlled. So the 19th century before electricity was centripetal, and the 20th century, which is pressured to be decentralized and less center control, less controlled by myth, is called centrifugal. The inclusive centralizing, inclusive means homogeneous, of ESP, I'm calling these new technologies ESP, were displaced for the exclusive decentralizing shades of ESP. Okay? That's what that means.
So the inclusive is like we're all in this together. Makes everyone
it's
feel
in
like
a factory. You're working your butt off, and you've got to be there. You can't leave the fucking factory. You got to be there for 14 hours, or you'll not be allowed in, and then you starve. So you can't be too centrifugal when the society and its dinners and food eating is focused around a factory industrial environment, as you'll see, the pre-electric industrial technologies.
And everyone just went along with it. Like everyone just was just in it.
They were forced to. No, they were forced to.
Okay.
The landlord says, "Get the hell off our property. We're building a factory here." And so, where are you going to go? So you go to London and live in a ghetto. This is a disruption that happened, all over the British Isles, say, with the invention of the steam engine and whatever else they invented in the 1770s, 1810s, So by 1880, everybody's working in a factory. Or a good chunk of the population is not working in the factory, but the people that are working in the factory are making, because of the productivity, making all kinds of novelty and products that interfere with your agricultural routine. So in that sense, the factory is a small environment, but it's very influential or constitutive. That word, constitutive.
Mm-hmm.
It shapes people.
And then the blocking came in with the printing press?
The blocking was enhanced by the printing press because you could go off and be by yourself and have a communication experience with a book. If you want to have a communication before the book, you got to do it with humans. And people want to communicate to distract their attention from whatever they're bothered by. Their boredom.
So that's when everyone became opinionated and distant.
Yeah. They started arguing and having wars over definitions of things.
So I'm going to continue.
Yeah.
The pre-electric industrial technologies and their inevitable environments only exaggerated the bifurcating qualities of the collective consciousness. However, the inclusive qualities of the social drama of cognition were renewed when the electric environments were developed via the telegraph, telephone, radio, and television technologies. That is why Blavatsky, Einstein, Gurdjieff, and Crowley were able to derail the Newtonian locomotive. But the exclusive factors quickly retorted with the automotive, movie, airplane, and satellite environments. This accelerated.
Not the automotive, the automobile.
Oh, automobile, yes. Movie, airplane, and satellite environments. This accelerated macroscopic dialogue between the exclusive stimulation of the time or vertical school and inclusive stimulation of the space or horizontal school. Dancers in a virtual drama of cognition left all perceptions and models of ESP as the exuberance of being through language in the milieu of dangling ganglia.
Okay, let's see. Anybody, I kept Brian open. Any questions there? Are you getting this, Kate?
Yeah. It's pretty good. I never read it before, so it was necessary.
What was necessary?
To go through this essay.
Before?
Just like...
Or just now?
Like now with you. Or
well,
in general.
It was necessary to read it first.
Yeah, I did.
And that didn't... Was
but
it
going
hard to understand?
Yeah, of course. But now going through it with you, it's making more sense.
Okay.
How much more sense?
Yeah.
Well, I'm starting to see a bigger picture of it. Because before, I didn't know any of this.
It's I'm just remembering and reappreciating. I'm just remembering how, like, when it, as a new idea to me, I really appreciated this. That instead of it being, you know, you've got ESP and then the opposite of ESP, that you're instead emphasizing that, you know, both merging and blocking are both forms of ESP. It's ESP all the way down. You know, you've got the exclusive ESP as well as the inclusive ESP. Like you can, you get just as much of a implied impression of participating in a cultural gesture or something from blocking just as much as from merging and telling yourself that you get it. Like when you tell like, oh, I really get what this person's saying, then sure, you feel like you have some ESP with them, but it's easy to assume that if you, well, I don't understand what they're saying at all, that I'm not having ESP with them. This clarification.
Yeah, and that would be the blocking, Brian.
Yeah,
and what is part of blocking is distracting things that distract. Oh, I missed that sentence, but I don't want to interrupt them to get them to repeat it. You know, there's other thought processes going on which are inside these simple terms merging and blocking, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
that's
the thinking, your responses are blocking or merging or both or overlapped or imprecise, you know, this is this is why McLuhan said there's not much matching going on in human communication. He would just say there's not much communication going on, but most people would think that means matching. And so he started talking about how there's a lot of non-communication going on, which you did not point out in polite society. All right?
Right. Right.
So he's being rude.
Well, exactly, because that's the sort of negative ESP or something, or the blocking ESP.
Yeah.
Everyone goes to the party, and they all chat it up, like, we're having a great time communicating back and forth, and then all of the sharp wits go back to their notebooks and write aphorisms about how nobody ever really understands each other, and they all just can't. You know, it's
right.
you're having ESP with the blocking, and you can
basically
sense that other people are doing the same thing you're doing.
Yeah, it's like any form of communication evokes a lot. So there's merging and blocking going on inside yourself with the thoughts you will pay attention to about the responses they had or what you had to them. There's a lot of thinking, half-formed thoughts quickly happening. That's why you would say it was like nonverbal and mental dance are good terms for this subtle. Right now, Brian, you're thinking different things about what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
Half-form thoughts. Then if I say, okay, respond, you'll create a one of those thoughts and say something.
I try to match one of my own thoughts.
Beg your pardon?
I see if I can match the thought with words.
Yeah. So I think that when I'm talking to people, I often laugh to myself because I assume that they're having all kinds of other thoughts they're not saying to me. So the lying is always in there. It's not an important lying, but there's lots of stuff not said. And that's why people smirk at each other or that other facial stuff comes in. And we'll lump that into ESP because you can't stop the conversation. Did you just get a little subtle thing thought about that right at that moment there? Imagine trying to track and get them to acknowledge what you thought they were thinking in the other part when they were speaking. There was parts they were leaving out.
Right. That's the grammar.
I demand you to tell me what you were thinking that you didn't tell me, you know?
Yeah. Can you even remember what you were thinking?
Yeah. It's so subtle and quick. Now, probably on psychedelics, it slows down that process, and then you get all involved in that subtlety, right?
Yeah, you can, that seems fair.
Yeah, you get lost in it. I mean, basically, the Evergreen said that LSD scrambled the normal channels of nerves and synapses being going along, making a coherent consciousness. But if you scramble that, that's when you don't know what you're thinking and what ESP to rely on. So you either freak out or you get blissed out by it, either way. But that's a key thing, that LSD scrambles the sensory part of yourself, at least in the beginning of the trip.
Right. Yes. Or seems to speed it up to the point where you can't handle it anymore, although physiologically they seem to have determined that these, at least the psilocybin, that it actually decreases brain activity rather than increasing it, which is counterintuitive to most people, but it makes sense with that, like, doors of perception, idea that, normal consciousness, you're putting in a lot of effort to keep that door open. To keep that door mostly closed. And then the psychedelics make it so that you're less able to close that door. Your door closing arm weakens and it opens more than a crack. And it seems like it has the subjective expression of a speed up, but it's actually you weakening. It's your brain slowing down.
Yeah, when you read Clinton's essay, Metamorphosis, he talks about he reduces a lot of the cybernetic psychology is reduced to differentiation and integrating. These two processes go on in the perceiver. And I recognized that it was blocking and merging, and so did he. So we talked about that you could make an underlying, you take my clone ESP and bring in the McLuhan points about matching and making or merging and blocking, that would integrate all the different weird psychologies that are dividing things into blocking, merging, but using different complicated words like differentiating and integrating. So he liked that I showed him how to make the deeper ground McLuhan, which is what he's trying to do. He's trying to get people to Substack or full stack back to McLuhan and realize a lot of these people are doing improvised shadings and nuances of a McLuhan perception they don't know about.
Right. Right.
So I was trying to do that here. If you know McLuhan stuff, I'm talking McLuhan there, but didn't want to use his terms because people block on the legacy of McLuhan terminology. You know, he's a boring guy. He lived 50 years ago. He's not important. You know, that part of their blocking ESP intuitions come in. So you try to counter that. And that's what you do when you're looking for a word, when you're talking here, and I'm looking for explaining what Kate read. I'm searching around for ways to match with her or to illustrate it. So I start talking a sentence and I intuit, oh, she's not getting that one. I'll drop those words and I'll say these words. Now, I'm doing that right now as I talk. I just heard myself, as I talk, right? You listen.
Yeah.
Are you aware of yourself when you talk? I'm often surprised that people don't hear themselves while they're talking.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, you're also part of the audience for yourself as you talk.
Yeah.
And overhear yourself, and you know, you're kind of in the audience's shoes, and then you hear something you said and you're like, oh no, that's not likely to, in the laboratory of your own mind, you think, well, that's not likely to come across the way I wanted it, because that's not the way I heard it when I heard myself talking just now.
Right.
So
is that why
credit.
People
so
that was is that why people don't people don't like listening to themselves on the radio or something after they speak?
Probably.
Oh yeah. Yeah, because they don't know it's not the same experience that they heard in their chemical body skull.
Mm.
You're electrified, and then you hear a replay, and you're thinking all these people heard it and all these other crazy thoughts you think. And on top of it, it's like when I thought I heard James B., and it was certain it was James B. Then we went to another medium, and it wasn't James B.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't notice these shifting environments that they're in their daily experience. Or if they do, they're spun off by it and bothered. Oh, man, I sounded horrible. I thought I was making sense. I didn't make any fucking sense, you know? And they should notice that the medium is tricking them into thinking they didn't make any sense. Because different thoughts are evoked when you're listening to yourself replayed on the radio. So anyways, this kind of talk, you don't do this kind of talking much in daily communication, right?
No.
Right. But this is art, right? Or attempted art. Like, it's an anti-environmental talk. We're trying to talk a Perseus's mirror to see the Gorgon of speech, everyday speech.
Yeah, and we're making a novelty of how much thinking we're doing that we don't get a chance to talk about. And see how that goes. Maybe after 15 minutes, Greg's had enough of this kind of talk. You know, he wants to talk about something, what is solid for him and not that. Just Greg as an example. But it's interesting how long people can put up with this kind of talk.
Yeah.
You're muted.
Why do you say that?
Because Chad is talking.
Oh, okay. You're telling him.
is not saying anything at all a form of blocking?
Oh, yeah. You never stop communicating. Silence is a big communicator. Just, you know, when I say something and I wait for you to respond, and then after 2.5 seconds you haven't responded, I start thinking, oh, did they not hear me? Do they don't like it? Are they dumbfounded at what to say?
Yeah.
Those thoughts come in immediately. If you're sensitive, I guess you call it, numbskulled or thick-headed people don't seem to, they're not sensitive to that kind of checking what's going on in that little five-second moment.
Mm-hmm.
Or they are, but they don't communicate it well, you know?
I mean, you must be very used to that, Bob, the those silences,
yes,
are a very common phenomenon with you.
Yeah. That's why I was a good DJ. I fell in with music.
Yeah.
But then I don't mind the silence. I'm not trying to get status out of diminishing the silence response. That's why it's not lonely.
You're trying to create the silence. That silence is affirmation to you.
Yeah, I want them to get silent often.
Shut up. Yeah.
And notice.
If you said something and someone came in immediately with response, you'd be going, oh no, this is bad.
Yeah, too quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, what am I going to do? This guy's actually dealing with it. But if you say something and then everybody goes, then you have to force people to say something.
That'll create a certain number of assumptions about why did everybody shut up? Did they blow them away? Now, this guy, I think his name's Pablo Schwartz or something. I can't remember. I see his name all the time. I make a post on my Facebook page. Within 5 fucking seconds, he's liking it. He's been doing this for fucking decades, okay?
I think he's
starting to bug me, but I ignore him. But
what is he
doing? It's so fucking ridiculous that he's on there.
He's a super fan on Facebook, but pretty much only in the reacting.
Yeah.
What is he do?
He's supporting whatever I post. Well, that's cheating. I try to get you to maybe say something. He never posts a response.
I'll say something to him about it.
I'll bring my army in. It's time. He's gotten away with 10 years of this shit. It's time he'd be brought up before the courts.
I'd love it's not appropriate.
But don't you think we live in a society that...
I'd love to hear his voice. Because these people I've been interacting with, more or less frequently, but over Facebook for so many years, and I just accept that I know them as this name, and I've seen like one photo.
Yeah.
Don't know anything else about how they are.
Yeah. Does he respond real quickly to your posts?
Well, I mean, the way the algorithm's gone over the years, like, these days I post something and often enough it gets no reactions at all. Even if it's the sort of thing that used to get lots of good reactions, it's just like the algorithm's not showing it to people or something. So I don't necessarily get a lot of likes from him, but the algorithm knows that he likes your content, and generally if I post something like a quote from you, he comes in and gives it that thumbs up or even that heart.
There's this other guy, Olivia. He's got a weird Spanish name. He's always hearting my stuff, but he's responding too quickly also. He never said anything. He just fucking hearts me and a lot of stuff. That's useless. He's dead to me. You know, he's not providing clues to his ESP or my ESP. You're not giving me any chance to have some ESP.
Don't you think that most people, like, say, what's going on in these interactions on Facebook? Everybody seems to like what anybody does.
Yeah.
There's very rarely that somebody comes in and goes, well, or disagrees, or even modifies, or goes, well, like, there are people that put up animation on their, you know, there are people who want to be in animation or do animation, and they put stuff up, and everybody goes, great, terrific, oh, that's good. And I'm the only one that'll go, I'll try and put in, like, if I see that somebody is making an effort, and is along the right track, and I can see something, you know, that isn't working, or that they could improve it in some way, then I'll write how it could be improved or what they could do, something that isn't working, you know? And I think I'm not saying it's shocking to the person who did it, maybe, I can't say, but I get the feeling it's shocking to everybody else. We just went, yeah, great, 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 great. because that's just the way people are. They want to be, people want to encourage other people. I get that. In my particular way, my level of encouraging people, and sometimes if I really think something's terrific, I'll say it. But, you know, as someone who's, you know, and I feel I come with a bit of authority too. You know, I don't go into that. I mean, I'm just making a suggestion. I don't know anybody will know who I am, what I've done, or anything. But, you know, I'm just trying to help. And that's my method of encouragement. And there's that long pause. With a little bit of surface noise. Crunching. Beatboxing.
Well, I gotta kill the, we can't have dead air.
Well, then we had a good dead air there.
Yeah, you know.
And I was gonna say something about what you were talking about 10 minutes ago, or 15 minutes ago, maybe. It was in relation to the Francis Ford Coppola thing, and you were talking about, I think, Bob, you were saying something about people going home and reading a book, or reading a book and that is private. Well, Coppola is saying, and I think Coppola is saying the same thing about home video, that in a lot of ways, that's a solitary experience. He's saying, no, you should all get together. When you get together, it becomes a bigger experience than it would have been otherwise. I'll accept that.
Hello?
Yes, hello. What, did we go away?
Not sure where everyone went.
Where did everybody go?
I don't know.
There's Brian's muted, maybe. Is he? Were you muted on purpose, Brian, or?
Yes, I'm muted, so you can't.
On purpose, okay. All right. I don't know. I don't know where Bob. Where's Bob? Oh well. Are you hesitating carrying on, Kate? Because you're not
I'm just waiting for Bob.
Yeah.
I guess I could just continue, but I was going to ask more about what Neil.
Yeah. No. Don't continue. Yes. I apologize, but I had to mute. I had things going on here that I had to fucking deal with. So I fucked up the blocking and merging rhythm by being unaccountable. My ESP was gone for 5 minutes.
So
I watched the confusion unfold, but I couldn't do anything about it. So there we have it. I apologize for it. But look, if I'm not there, know that I'm probably 99% of the time there, but I had to mute for some reason. And I'm actually hearing you.
I'm just glad that I got such a long silence after I said something.
Yeah, that was a nice experience, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it rarely happens.
The silence you get on the phone is different than the silence you get in real life, because then you can see their eyes. Like, maybe they're, like, thinking with a smile on their face. Or, you know, like, you can tell more what the silence means by their body language.
Yeah, it's called living. Living is fun. You're always communicating and reacting and thinking and watching and judging, you know. That's never stops.
Right. So nothing you explain in this essay is bad or wrong. You're just saying, you're just explaining what is.
Yeah, now this idea, is it bad or wrong? That's a big assumption in people, that they communicate. A lot of communication is objections. So if you don't have a point of view, that seems silly to people. That means you're not able to object. You don't have any basis to object to. And a lot of people object. Or they just say, well, they want to say something different from whatever you say. So that's differentiation. That's blocking. You say something, I'm going to mention something else about whatever it was we're talking about to bother you or to point out to you that you missed this angle, or I just shut up and say nod emphatically and agree. So this complexity of communication and variety is always going on. And that's probably why I laugh a lot, because I tune into people hiding their communication. It's not a negative hiding. It's a way of being efficient.
Hmm.
So when Madeline objects to Greg, every now and then that's entertaining, but it shouldn't be just that kind of response. If you object to somebody, you got to come up with a way to not object to them so they can hear that part. So there's a bit of merging there, and you're not just seen as a shit disturber or someone who's negative about somebody. So that's another part of the drama cognition, is gauging how much you get along with people by not telling them everything, but that's not important to say everything. So that value, people say, well, you know when to shut up, you know. You know when to lie. There's an ecology to that, right? And it's probably not a good word, lying, because it becomes dramatically condemned or something. But there's so much that you don't say to people that you could have. If you know them well, you can retrieve things that they forgot they did, but you remember, and you can throw it at them. So there's a lot of politeness about that. Mm-hmm. I would say there's not so much politeness here because we don't even know what we're talking about. It's so complex that we welcome any response, even if it's negative.
Right. I mean, even when we're, it's possible that even when we're making a positive response, it's perceived as being negative.
Yeah, or they're just being polite. So I always say, don't be polite. Don't be rude. Do not worry about negative emotions. Leave them at home. Engage at whatever level you want to say and respond to, and see how long we can put up with that.
So is the dangling ganglia like our brains trying to understand everything? But
yeah.
It's
the open-ended, not getting closure, as people say. You know, there's so much going on that you can't get to talk about to anybody else, or to even have your own thoughts about them. This is how Clinton defines psychosis. So much, you open yourself up to too much data coming in, and you don't have time to comment on it or to notice what thoughts you have about it. Besides the thoughts you're forced to say because you're with somebody and they want to know how you're reacting. So dangling ganglia, I saw that once years ago, and I said, that's a great phrase. That, you know, we've got our nervous system extended out there, dangling around, and we're not even aware of what it can communicate. So a lot of the complaints in society are that people are getting dumber and dumber. That may be a miscalculation of the effect of increasing dangling ganglia. In other words, people are actually being more attentive. They're quiet. They're not yelling, but they're quiet, and they're not sure what to say, which is what that McLuhan quote says. The multiplicity of the media just becomes too much for people, and they can't take it. So we've had to be like that for 60 years. So we've learned to take not understanding or not listening to all the thoughts we have about things that go on. So you have that phrase, whatever, right?
Yeah.
You might have a way of saying it differently 300 years ago, but I would say that people didn't go whatever in a simpler, slower data-contained environment. They could respond. Like, you know, this is why McLuhan called it, 50 years ago, the silent majority. He knew that it wasn't that they were shy and afraid to speak. That would be more 30s and 20s audience in the decades. he meant that more and more people were getting stunned and didn't know what thoughts they had about all this novelty of stuff that was happening. Like Trump has created a great silence and rage, but a silent rage in his odd performances in that political role that nobody thought was wise to act like.
So whatever the description of the definition of that particular whatever is said as a response indicating a reluctance to discuss something, implying indifference, skepticism, or exasperation.
Yeah, that's what Ion explained what people meant by interesting. When they say it was interesting, often people say, well, that's interesting. What does that mean, Ion? He says they actually do find it slightly interesting, but the kind of thoughts they'd utter would complicate things. And they're also maybe not sure where it's going, so it actually is a threat to make you look stupid because you're not sure what this novel situation evokes in you. So when people say interesting, there's a big blocking factor in that. They're not interested and they're not going to get interested, right? But they can't be blatant, so they do the in-between matching and merging and say, interesting, yeah, very interesting thought you have there. I ain't going into it. I'm going to ignore it. So
that's
that was a good description of that word. Have you ever heard of anybody explain that cliche like that?
No, they've never explained it. Americans, I've found, maybe Canadians too, if you take an American or if you give them some food that they're not used to, they'll go, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And they'll say it almost like they're being polite.
Yeah.
Yet
they want you to notice they want you to notice they're lying almost.
Yeah, they're really saying that was horrible, but I don't want to say it. I mean, I almost wish they would say that was horrible because you could discuss it. But when someone says that's interesting, you know,
they're blocking discussing. They're making it uninteresting. It's a lie.
Yeah, yeah. You know it, but to actually start going, what do you mean interesting? Like they're always begging you to do that so they can say, well, it tastes like shit. Right? They need you to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just sit there and you go, and then, like, basically when they say, well, that's interesting, then you're going, I'm not going to go any further with this. I'm just going to let things just sit here. Because I'm enjoying the meal. I think it's pretty good. And I'm not going to rock the boat. I'm just going to keep eating. I don't want to disturb the digestion.
Hey, you know what? I just thought that part of this juggling of merging and blocking is we recognize that humans are violent. They're easily upset, too easily upset. So you're always judging that factor, too, about how much you want to agitate somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very polite. We're very civilized in many ways. Civilized meaning giving up your instinctual blatant disagreement with something or complaint about something.
Yeah.
Now that politeness thing was apparently in the 19th century the rule. They would say don't discuss religion or politics at the parties, at the social life. Well, 100 years later, it's all that fucking people do. Is complain and yell and scream at parties and blat out their opinions about things, right? They go to parties to hear competing opinions.
And
so that's
one of the things the beat poets did for us is they made it cool to talk about religion at like a party.
Yeah. 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 So something switched about what was polite and what wasn't. And that's another, meaning that McClellan was into, because this woman came to a Monday night thing. I always remember this one. And she was writing a new etiquette book. And after, so she does her, she lays out what she's doing, and people started misinterpreting it or making up shit about it or trying to look smart. And then McLuhan said, well, what you're doing is what exactly what we do here. We study the manners of society. The manners.
Right.
You know, mind your manners. And people never thought McLuhan dealt with the manners. That's too superficial and silly and bourgeois to be concerned about manners. So
right.
When he said that, everybody shut up. Why is he saying that? We study manners?
Yeah, that's brilliant. That is absolutely it. You know, that's the decorum of how we settle on using a new medium as a semi-automatic function of the previous media rather than consciously deciding how we're going to treat the new medium. We have manners about what kind of TV show to make or whatever.
Yeah.
The whole thing where I was describing about the interesting and about eating food, etiquette would have it that you would say, it's delightful, right? but a lack of etiquette yields interesting.
Yeah. The thing is, people have different personalities or different ways to deal with the potential violence of anything or the unpleasantness of it. So some people are phony and say delicious all the time, and they think that's, from their value system, that's good. Someone else with a different temperament will find that irritating. You're always just saying everything's delicious. Fuck that. It ain't always delicious. You know what I mean? So there are people even have different ideas about what's phony and not phony. So I find the old-fashioned years and decades ago, the politeness thing was a bigger factor in society. My temper was I found it irritating. So I didn't like social shit because people – it was like they were so neurotic – about being alone, they'll do anything to be with a bunch of people and to be sort of liked and accepted, and they'll lie their asses off during it because it's not about the unpleasantness of the tensions of being bourgeois. It's just, I don't like being alone. So I want to be with people. I'll put up with them. And someone else who doesn't mind being alone, they don't like these people who are neurotically afraid of being alone. So what we're saying here is kind of the subtleties people read in novels. Novels would describe the unspoken, right? Back a couple hundred years ago. And so you would write a book and people would go off privately and say, oh, this is what everybody was thinking or doing that we didn't admit when we were together. So there's the privacy thing is built up by the book medium. Then when you got radio and everybody's here at the same shit, same time in the same house, that upsets the role of the private book, the service of the private book. Actually, people don't get to hear subtleties. So, you know, people like Coppola complained about when special effects started with Star Wars in 77, they'll say in that book about 70s filmmakers, what's it called, Easy Riders and Smoking Stones or something, the fighting movie. Anyways, a lot of those guys, the book was written at the end of the 70s, early 80s, talking about all the guys who did this golden age of movies, like Coppola and Scorsese in the middle 70s, and they often said that the special effects stuff that took over with Star Wars ruined the music industry, the movie industry, the way they understood it and the way they liked doing it. And Coppola seemed to be a major complainer of that stuff. He got pissed off by 79. And then what has he done since then? In interviews, he talked about he's experimented with different things, but I don't know any of it. I don't know what he did. Nothing really stood out, did it? What stands out, maybe one movie after Apocalypse Now? Did he do The Conversation?
That was before.
Oh yeah, that's 71 or 2. That was a good movie. Yeah, he did that before Apocalypse. But what do you know him doing in the 80s and 90s. Did anything stand out? Without looking at Wikipedia.
Yeah, Bram Stoker's Dracula is really good.
And he did that? When did he do that?
92 or something, I think it was. Or it was first half of the 90s, anyway.
But see, that's 15 years later. What did he do in the 80s? Remember he tried an experiment? Did he start DreamWorks or something? They were going to make a repertory company of guys.
Tootrope.
Yeah. What happened to that?
I don't know. Didn't work.
Yeah. What was it?
I don't know.
I don't even know what it was.
Hollywood or something. It was like trying to get out of Hollywood.
Yeah. They probably were reacting to the special effects takeover.
I think he tried to do that with Lucas. And...
Yeah. All the good guys of the 70s, even though Lucas betrayed them all.
Yeah.
He made Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he started it. And you know what came out? I remember in 77, that I went and saw that, but very close to that, I saw Annie Hall. And I probably liked Annie Hall better because it had McLuhan in it, and it was an interesting dilemma about L.A. versus New York. It's more interesting, more nuanced than... It's so stupid, these big action movies. It's just a lot of fighting, and then someone gets beat up, and that's good or bad, and then they have another one. Fucking crude, man. And some people, maybe as I'm not so visual, they like the special effects as it's enhanced, as they redo the violence with more fucking decoration around it. Or methods of looking at it, right? That that looking at violence better and gore stuff better doesn't aesthetically please me. So I'm more of a verbal person, probably. I like people talking, interacting.